Hello and welcome to Drinking on the Last Frontier. Thanks to Recess Duty for leading us in there. This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. And I'm your host, Bill Howell, for Drinking on the Last Frontier. In this month's show, we'll be covering, besides news, the discussion about brewery taprooms in the state of Alaska. Are they a good thing or a bad thing? We'll have interviews with the Kenai Peninsula Brewing and Tasting Society, which is our local homebrew club and beer club. And our style this month will be India Pale Ales. Yes, the one you've all been waiting for. We're going to talk about IPAs. And finally, beer gear returns after taking a month off. So welcome to Drinking on the Last Frontier. In this month's beer news, with the coming of fall, Alaska's seasonal breweries are closing their doors. Seward Brewing Company closed for the season on Sunday, September 17th, and 49th State Brewing's Healy location closed on Monday, September 25th. Cooper Landing Brewing Company is officially open for business. The brewery received its final license from the state on August 29th, and its beers are now on draft at a couple of locations around Cooper Landing. If you're looking for some to take home, it is available sporadically at Wild Man's Liquor Store in 32-ounce cans. On a recent visit, there were four varieties on offer: a pale ale, an IPA, a brown ale, and a rhubarb ale. Cooper Landing Brewing hopes to build a new brewery building next year, which will feature a true tap room. Hoodoo Brewing opened its newly rebuilt beer garden with a ribbon cutting by the mayor of Fairbanks on September 16th. That date also marked the beginning of Oktoberfest celebrations there and at many other breweries across the state. A new ruling from the state's Alcoholic Beverage Control Board has prohibited distilleries from serving mixed drinks in their tasting rooms, something the distilleries have been doing since 2014. Several distilleries have refused to comply with the board's order, setting the stage for a court fight over the issue. I'll have more about this in this month's feature segment later in the show. Kodiak Island Brewing Company has begun offering its beers in 32-ounce crowler cans. The cans come in both single-use and refillable versions. Midnight Sun Brewing released the second beer in its Wild Adventure series on September 16th, Sporter, a sour porter brewed with wild yeast and aged in oak barrels. It weighs in at 7.5% alcohol by volume. With the coming of fall, the brewery has also released this year's version of its Belgian-style barley wine, Termination Dust. Bear Paw River Brewing in Wasilla has purchased a canning line and has begun canning its Frontiersman IPA and Matt Made Milk Stout in 6-packs of 12-ounce cans. The brewery has also released a new beer for draft distribution, Hatcher Pass Pale Ale, weighing in at 5% alcohol by volume and 35 IBUs. This beer will be released in 12-ounce six-packs also, most likely next spring. Kenai River Brewing has begun serving Sunday brunch from 11 to 2 p.m. on Sundays, followed by the brewery closing at 3 p.m. AB InBev has announced the layoff of hundreds of employees from its High End, the division of the company which houses its recently purchased craft brewing labels. Due in large part to its recent acquisition of craft breweries, AB InBev has added more than 2,000 employees in recent years. Alex Medicis, the vice president of sales for Anheuser-Busch, explained in a letter to wholesalers how a new structure would allow the division to work with wholesalers in, quote, a more efficient and effective way, end quote. District managers and sale representatives for the high end were most affected by the restructuring. Many wholesalers were working with multiple district managers, some that represented the brewery's core brands and others that represented the high end. The new structure allows for a single district manager to handle both core brands as well as those in the high end, according to Medicis. The new structure also eliminates the role of sale representatives for the high end in an effort to simplify points of contact between wholesalers and breweries. AB InBev will, however, be adding inventory managers to work with district managers and regional craft brewery managers. The layoffs will amount to less than 2% of the company's 18,000 employees in North America. Kevin Burton, the longtime head brewer at Glacier Brewhouse in Anchorage, has left that job. Burton became head brewer there in 2001 and has overseen over 4,500 brews since then. Burton is now the operating partner at the new Matanuska Brewing Company in Palmer. The facility build-out is almost complete, and plans are to produce the first batch of beer no later than January 2018. Alaska Brewing has added last year's popular seasonal Husky IPA to its year-round offerings. The beer features mosaic hops and has an unmistakable tropical and fruity aroma. Quote, experimenting with mosaic hops, we knew we wanted to brew an IPA with them, something that highlights the juicy mosaic flavor without being too overpowering or overly sweet, said Tyler Lindquist, brewer at Alaskan Brewing. These hops are celebrated for their complex, broad aroma backed by clean bittering, which makes a big impression. This beer really stands out from the pack when you're looking at the selection of IPAs available out there. That's it for this month's Brew News. In our next segment, we'll be talking about brewery tap rooms. Are they good or bad? This is Drinking on the Last Frontier with your host, Bill Howell, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. On our feature story today, we ask the question, brewery tap rooms, good or bad? At first glance, you might think the question I asked is a no-brainer. Of course, brewery tap rooms or tasting rooms are a good thing. After all, Georgia just recently came the last of the 50 states to finally legalize them, much to the joy of its citizens. Craft beer lovers enjoy being able to stop in and have a pint before taking home a growler or two to drink later. Most cities love them, as they are just the sort of business to revitalize an area and lack many of the problems associated with true bars selling hard liquor. The brewers love them, as they get to sell their beer at the retail price and thereby capture the margins which would normally go to the wholesaler and the retailer. In fact, many small, and some not so small, breweries couldn't survive if they didn't have the steady revenue stream that flows into their coffers from taproom sales. So who could be against them? Earlier in the show, I mentioned a news item. The state's Alcoholic Beverage Control Board recently reversed its policy of the last 3 years and decreed that craft distilleries cannot serve mixed drinks in their tasting rooms. This would prohibit the distilleries from offering anything except straight samples of their various products. Not even cutting the booze with water would be allowed. Why would the ABC board make such a radical ruling? Well, it received a complaint that distilleries in Juneau were selling cocktails. The complaint was anonymous, but it almost certainly came from an owner of one of the local Juneau bars, upset at the perceived competition from the local distillery's tap rooms. Many bar owners across the state feel threatened by the ability of breweries and distilleries to sell their products directly to the public and have done everything in their power via their trade organization, the Alaska Cabaret, Hotel, Restaurant, and Retailers Association, also known as Alaska Char, to hamstring the concept of direct sales by breweries and distilleries. Ever wonder why you're limited to 36 ounces per person per day at Kenai River Brewing or Cassick's Brewery? Char demanded that limit when tap rooms were first legalized. Ever wonder why there's no entertainment, not even a TV, set up in your local brewery's tap room? Char again. Why is it that brewery tap rooms can only have a serving counter, not a bar that you can sit at? Char, of course. Where did some of the ridiculous limitations on the percentage of a brewery's total sales that can be from a tap room that appear in the current draft of SB 76 originate? Yep, you guessed it, char. Basically, many bar owners in Alaska think that if you are denied any other options, you'll just have to come and drink in their establishments. They're like taxi drivers who are afraid consumers will choose a cheaper option like Uber or Lyft, so they demand that the state outlaw the competition. Sad to say, the politicians of Alaska often seem more interested in the desires of lobbyists for the likes of Char than in what the people they are supposed to be serving want. And what is it that the people want? Judging by their popularity, the people want tasting rooms. Nationwide, in 2016, 9.4% of sales from small and independent brewers occurred at the brewery, up from only 7% in 2015. Here in Alaska, since brewery tap rooms were legalized in 2006, the number of craft breweries has exploded, from less than a dozen to over 30. The legalization of distillery tap rooms in 2014 has had a similar effect, with 8 distilleries now open statewide. For many of these new businesses, it was the tap room and the revenue stream it could generate from day one that made them feasible. Castrate the tap room, and you ensure that no more new breweries or distilleries will be opening their doors, which seems to be the ultimate goal behind these efforts. Personally, I think this attitude is incredibly short-sighted. I think a rising tide can lift all boats here. Successful breweries and distilleries mean more jobs, more economic activity, more tourism, and a generally improved quality of life, all of which is of benefit to the hospitality industry in general and bar owners in particular. This need not be a zero-sum game, even though that seems to be how some people want to play it. To see it that way is a fundamental misreading of human nature. Speaking for myself, if all the brewery tap rooms on the peninsula closed tomorrow, I wouldn't suddenly start doing my drinking at one of the local bars. I'd just drink more at home. I think in this I'm not alone. Brewery taps in Alaska already are subject to many restrictions to ensure they don't compete directly with bars. They are limited in how much they can serve, can only serve their own products, can't have entertainment, can't have bars with seating, can't be open after 8 p.m., and so on and so on. If you are a bar owner and a neighboring brewery or distillery is still costing you business despite all the restrictions it has on it, maybe the problem is with you and not with them. There's a Latin phrase that cops and lawyers use, cui bono, which translates as for whose benefit. It's a particularly useful question to ask when you're trying to figure out who has a motive for a crime. As you read stories in the newspapers about popular distilleries' tasting rooms being crippled by new interpretations or new restrictions on tap rooms being proposed in the legislature that will keep any new breweries from ever seeing the light of day in this state, ask yourself that question. Who benefits? I'll give you one hint. It won't be you or me. We'll be back in just a moment with our interviews from the Kenai Peninsula Brewing and Tasting Society. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier with your host, Bill Howell, on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Well, this is your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. And our interviews this month will be at the monthly meeting of the Kenai Peninsula Brewing and Tasting Society. The Brewing and Tasting Society meets the first Thursday of every month at 6:30 at the Shriners Hall on West Poppy Lane. So we're here this month and we're going to be talking to various members of the club and the club president, Leah Vick, to find out what we can about the club and why people brew their own beer and are members of the club. We're talking to president of the society, Leah Vick. Leah, why don't you take a minute and tell us a little bit about the society?
Thanks, Bill. We meet once a month here at the Shriners Hall on Poppy Lane, and it's just very much geared towards, you know, people that just have a passion for beer and brewing. A lot of us are home brewers, but it's not a requirement. You can come here and bring your home brews, or you can come and bring brews that you're just super excited about to share with other people. And that's just kind of the emphasis of the meetings is, you know, trying out new beers with each other, taking tasty notes, just comparing what we've found, different breweries that we've been to, and kind of mingling with like-minded people.
And what's the rough format for the meetings?
So generally for the first, 30, 45 minutes or so, we just have a table that's set up with beers to share. People bring different beers in that they're excited about or home brews that they want to share with other people. And then after that, we roll right into the formal sampling portion, which we usually have about 6 samples, roughly 1 to 2 ounces each. And we go through and we try, and usually it's a theme. This month it's cans, and we're focusing on the new Anchorage Brewing Company cans, but different months we'll do different countries, different styles of beer. So just it varies from month to month what we choose.
All right, we're going to start pouring our sampling beers.
There you go.
Oh, you want me to?
Yeah.
So beer number 2 is Firestone's Uponic Distortion, and they do different series. This is Revolution number 6, so like every one is a different style. This one is driven by a mix of 7 different hop varieties, and it's the first ever West Coast beer to focus on Michigan burn hops. And typically, tiny dank attributes of these hops are transformed into something much brighter.
I mean, dank.
History of the Kenai Peninsula Brewing and Tasting Society. I have to admit that I was the founder of the club. I created it, 5 or 6 years ago now. I'd have to go back and look and see exactly when it was. But the idea was that we didn't have any kind of a homebrew club here in the Central Peninsula. There was one down in Homer, and there's one in Seward, and there's a huge one up in Anchorage, the Great Northern Brewers. But there really wasn't anything local for the people that were interested in being homebrewers or getting feedback on their homebrew, or who just really wanted just to get together and taste beer. After being president for a couple of years, I very happily stepped back to being just a beer drinker emeritus. I still make it to most of the meetings simply because, A, I like the camaraderie of the people who are interested in the same thing that I'm interested in, and B, it is really a great opportunity to taste new beers. People are always bringing in beers that they got when they were on a trip out to the lower 48, or that somebody brought up here for them, or that they found somewhere. So to me, it's a great opportunity to go and sample beers, sample other people's homebrew. We have some really good homebrewers on the peninsula, and get feedback on my own beers. I bring my homebrews to meetings and have people tell me what they think of it, and it's great to get feedback from some experienced palates.
That is an oaked Scottish ale. So I can't afford an oak barrel, but I bought oak chips and poured it into the glass carboy and let it age for a few weeks.
Now we're talking to Dave Brighton, another member of the club. So Dave, how'd you get into homebrewing?
I was living in an area of Alaska that was expensive shipping, and decided to save money and avoid shipping water. So a friend of mine brewed beer, and I was like, well, I'll give that a try.
One of the things people probably might not know is where you people find the beers they bring in for the club meeting. So have you got any suggestions or places you go?
I think Country Liquor in Kenai has one of the best selections of craft brews. So I check there, but I usually check most places where I'm shopping.
Yeah, once you get the craft beer bug, you're kind of always on the lookout for it. I think Sacktown in Seward has got a pretty good selection these days, and the Grog Shop down in Homer is typically not too bad. So those are a couple other ones that I keep an eye out for. You do any shopping up in Anchorage?
Yeah, I like La Bodega. They usually have a really good selection, and their staff seems to be really experienced and knows how to give good advice.
So what's your favorite type of beer?
That's a tough question. I tend to like darker beers, but I also enjoy sours quite a bit. Not a big hop head, so that puts me at odds with a bunch of people around. I know that's a really popular style right now.
So what's your favorite local brewery?
I don't know. I think they're all good. Being that I like sours, I really enjoy the lambics that St. Elias does. But I did work right next door to Kenai River until they moved, and so I ended up there quite a bit just out of ease at the end of the workday. I'd head over and get one before I went home.
When you're looking for a beer to bring to the club meeting, what's your criteria?
So I feel like I'm a novice compared to some of you guys at the club. Generally, what I look for is something that I haven't seen before, and I think that will be new to the group, which can be challenging. So sometimes it's just new to me.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing I try to keep an eye out for, is a new release or something that has just been newly distributed into the area, something that folks haven't seen before.
I also like to use the club as a guinea pig. I try to do quite a bit of brewing and love to bring my beers and let you give a taste and let me know how I'm doing.
Well, hey, that's why we founded the club, was to give people feedback if they wanted it. So thanks again, Dave.
Absolutely.
I like that. Nice earthiness to it. You didn't like it. I'm saying it wasn't really a West Coast hop type beer, but
ooh, I like that
it says
one.
West Coast hops, but English malts.
Yeah, that's more what I got.
Now we're talking with Steve Ford, one of the longtime members of the club, former president of the club, I should mention. So, Steve, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into beer and home brewing and whatnot?
Looking back, I think I thought I was ahead of the curve, because back in college, we didn't drink just Budweiser. We went and got green-bottled Molson. Remember Molson Ale and Canadians? But I think the first craft beer I really drank was Red Hook Ale. ESB, and was kind of dabbling in that direction, and then I did the IPA route, like a lot of people have done, and gone on to that. I think I'm more into sours and farmhouse ales, saisons. So this was like an extended college course, I guess.
How long have you been doing craft beer then? How many years?
I dabbled in brewing for a couple years, and I hope to get back into it here next year. But probably from the mid-70s in college.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I don't...
by decade, so good job.
But, I think I was kind of plateaued at mid-70s through early 90s, and then I started getting back into some more higher-end beers.
So what's your favorite brewery?
Well, we've got a daughter that fortunately lives down in Portland, so I think they had 62 breweries in Portland now, and one of my favorites down there was the Commons, and Deschutes has always done a good job. But I'll tell you what, after our last trip down there, came back up, Anchorage Brewing, it's just out of this park how much flavor there is in an ounce of water. They're really ahead of it. They're going in the direction I like going in. So,
well, great, thanks for talking to us, Steve, appreciate it.
You bet, thank you.
Couple that I brought, I just drove back from Michigan and I picked them up at a couple old breweries. One's from Marquette, Michigan, which is in the UP. That's where my granddaughter goes to college, so they just kind of find you.
Once you get hooked on it, you find yourself looking for it everywhere you go.
I'm here talking now with Bill Boss. Bill, tell us how you got into home brewing.
Well, many years ago, my daughter gave me a little Mr. Beer beer kit, and I tried that and it came out fairly well, and now I got a lot bigger equipment. But yeah, that's pretty much how I started. Just kind of hobby thing that I don't work, so my daughter, they try and get me to do things.
Why do you think you like it so much? Why'd you keep doing it?
Well, I like beer. so that worked out really well. And then it's an interesting, I've had a lot of science and biology background, and so a lot of that all balances together to try and make something that works out good for you.
Yeah, I found that very interesting, to understand the science background and the decisions with the biology and the health of the yeast and things like that. So as how that impacts the flavor of the final product.
Oh, it makes a big difference. Yeah, I try and experiment with different things, and a lot of people find out that I'm a home brewer. And they ask me, have you ever made a bad beer? And my reply to them is, I've never thrown anything away.
Okay. So what's your favorite beer?
Right now I'm kind of leaning towards wheat beers, but I like a lot of stouts and porters. And I like to try different beers from smaller breweries, which here at the club we have quite a few of those. So, you know, people bring in different samples.
So what's your favorite local brewery?
Kenai River. I'm like three blocks away, so.
Well, that's convenient for sure, Bill. Thanks for taking the time out to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for interviewing me.
Thank you. Sure, you want to try this?
Crack open one.
And what are the dues for being a member?
It's $24 for a year per person or $30 for families. So if you want to bring your spouse, it's only $30 for the whole year. And you also get discounts at Arctic Brewing Supply and La Bodega in Anchorage and the brew shop in Homer.
And if somebody wants to join, the easiest way is to show up at one of the meetings, right?
Exactly. And if you just want to come to one meeting and see what it's all about, we highly encourage that. And if you want to continue to be a member, we just ask that you pay your dues. And if you just want to use it for the discounts, that's up to you. But it's a good time.
It's got habanero in it. Spicy. Yeah, it's got cinnamon and habanero chili peppers.
Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. It's time for this month's style, which, of course, as I teased earlier, is India Pale Ales, or IPA for short, the beer style which has been taking the U.S. and a fair part of the rest of the beer world by storm in the last few years. Before we start talking about the style, let's talk a little bit about its history. As the name implies, this style of beer originated during the days of the British Empire, when soldiers and civilian bureaucrats were sent out from Britain to rule the Indian subcontinent, or the Raj, as it was known. In the days before the opening of the Suez Canal, this journey involved a 6,000-mile sea voyage around Africa. To survive this journey, a beer needed to be both strong, since alcohol acts as a preservative, and well-hopped, as hops have antimicrobial properties, so they help beer keep. One of the ways that the beer was preserved was via the technique known as dry hopping. In it, handfuls of hops were added to the cask of finished beers. Besides preserving the beer, this had the added benefit of further infusing it with hop flavors and aromas. It should be noted that the most popular beer style of the late 18th and early 19th century, the dark beer known as porter, was also both strong and well hopped. It was perfectly capable of surviving the journey in fine shape, and in fact, hundreds of thousands of barrels were brewed under government contract, shipped to India, and issued to the rank and file soldiers of the British Army as part of their rations. However, the British class system created a demand among the officers and civilian officials for a different beer than that consumed by the lower class soldiers. So India Pale Ale was born as an upper-class brew, a more visually appearing substitute for the murky brown porters of the common soldiers. Obviously, there's a great deal more to this complex story than the simple summary I can give here. So if you'd like to learn the amazing history of India Pale Ale in more detail, I recommend a book by the British beer writer Peter Brown entitled Hops and Glory, One Man's Search for the Beer That Built the British Empire. When these officers and officials returned to Britain from India, many of them brought back their taste for these pale hoppy beers as well. This style of upper-class ale eventually came to supplant porter as the most popular beer in Britain, especially IPAs brewed in Burton-on-Trent, whose water supply had the right mineral combination for producing outstanding pale hoppy beers. Over the first half of the 20th century and two world wars, both the strength and hoppiness of IPAs were gradually reduced until the English IPAs of the 1960s and 70s were only shadows of their former selves and likely headed for eventual extinction. At this point, American craft brewers entered the picture. Disgusted with the insipid beers being produced by the large brewers, these pioneers were interested in intensifying the flavor profiles of their beers. Many consider Anchor Brewing's Liberty Ale, first produced by Fritz Maytag in 1975 for the bicentennial of Paul Revere's ride, to be the first American IPA. Made using the more assertive American Cascade hops rather than the more floral traditional English varieties, its 47 International Bittering Units, or IBUs, was considered insanely bitter at the time. With that, a new style was born, the American IPA. As the craft brewing revolution has continued, the American love affair, some might say mad obsession, with hops has also continued. IPAs have gotten progressively bitterer, with Liberty Ale's 47 IBUs now standing at the bottom end of the spectrum rather than the top. Furthermore, stronger, hoppier styles have been created, with double IPAs, triple IPAs, and imperial IPAs being common. For example, here in Alaska, Denali Brewing Company offers its Big Dipper, a double IPA with 8.5% alcohol by volume and 100 IBUs. Anchorage Brewing offers its Bitter Monk Double IPA at 9% alcohol by volume and 100 IBUs. While Midnight Sun Brewing produces Gluttony, a triple IPA with 10.5% alcohol and an absolutely palate-shattering 200 IBUs. Nor has the development of the style only been in the direction of more alcohol and bitterness. We have also seen variations such as black IPAs, red IPAs, and white IPAs. Brewers today make Belgian IPAs, which are beers produced using a Belgian yeast, something which never existed before. IPAs are brewed using any and all hop varieties, dry hopped, run through hop infusers, or even made using the powder from the new cryogenic hop techniques. Perhaps the most popular IPA style at this moment is the New England style IPA, so called because it originated at several breweries in that part of the country. It is characterized by having a very cloudy or murky appearance, much like fresh squeezed orange juice, due to the tremendous amount of late hop additions. The hop varieties used also give them a very tropical or fruity aroma. If you're looking to try a local IPA, I can't begin to list them all. In fact, it's a rare craft brewery in this country that doesn't offer one or more. When it comes to pairing with foods, you need to take care to avoid a clash due to the bitterness of the beer. Salty and fried foods pair very well, as do most grilled meats. The double or triple varieties can handle even more salt and fat. Think cured ham, maybe with pineapple, if the IPA's hops emphasize tropical fruit flavors. How long will IPAs rule the roost? Hard to say, but one thing seems for certain. India Pale Ales, in all their many incarnations, look to be here to stay. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. After the break, we'll be back with Beer Gear. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. For our final segment this month, it's the return of Beer Gear. There was no Beer Gear last month as the show was running a bit long, but it's back this month with a vengeance. I've got two new beer books to review, and then I'm going to have something to say about the latest beer gadget out there, countertop brewing machines. Now, let's talk Beer Gear. There's a new hardcover coffee table style beer book that has been published entitled The National Geographic Atlas of Beer, A Globe-Trotting Journey Through the World of Beer. Full disclosure, I was contacted by the publisher and sent a pre-publication electronic copy of the book to review. At 9 inches by 11 inches and over 300 pages, it's a very handsome volume, one you'll be proud to display. As you'd expect from a book by National Geographic, it's handsomely illustrated with more than 100 illuminating maps and 200 beautiful color photos. The text was written by well-known beer geographers Nancy Holst Pullen and Mark Patterson, and there are also beer recommendations from Garrett Oliver, the renowned brewmaster of Brooklyn Brewery. Included in the text, you'll find beer history, trends, and tastings across 6 continents, as well as how to order beer in 14 languages. Travel tips include the best breweries, beer festivals, and pubs in each location. Smart, compelling, and practical, this essential guide will help you discover the best beer wherever you are. It's available for $27.19 on Amazon and would make a lovely addition to any beer library or a great gift for any beer lover. In my earlier segment on India Pale Ale, I mentioned British author Pete Brown and his excellent book, Hops and Glory. Well, Brown has just released another new beer book, one that focuses on the ingredients that go into beer. It's called Miracle Brew, Hops, Barley, Water, Yeast, and the Nature of Beer. From the lambic breweries of Belgium, where beer is fermented with wild yeast drawn from the air around the brewery, to the aquifers below Burton-on-Trent, where the brewing water is rumored to contain life-giving qualities, Miracle Brew tells the full story behind the amazing role each of these fantastic four, a grass, a weed, a fungus, and water, has to play. Brown travels from the surreal madness of drink-sodden hop blessings in the Czech Republic to Bamberg in the heart of Bavaria, where malt smoked over an open flame creates beer that tastes like liquid bacon. He explores the origins of fermentation, the lost age of hallucinogenic gruit beers, and the evolution of modern hop varieties that now challenge wine grapes in the extent to which they are discussed and revered. Like just about anything else written by Brown, the book is lucid, insightful, and at times hilarious. Hardback copies are available now from Britain, and the U.S. paperback version will be released on October 12th for $19.95. Finally, let's talk about countertop brewing machines. As someone who is active in writing about beer, I frequently receive emails about new books and products. One of the growing trends for the last few years has been what are known as countertop brewing devices. These are machines which automate the brewing process to a greater or lesser degree. You may have heard of Pico Brew, which is the best known and makes several different models, but there are others. In fact, I just received an email from a company planning to launch a Kickstarter for what they say will be, quote, the Keurig for craft beer. Given how prevalent these devices are becoming, I thought it might be appropriate for me to say a quick word regarding what I think of them. Essentially, I refuse to review any of these machines here on Beer Gear because I disagree with their premise. Brewing your own beer is a wonderful thing, but if you are so limited in time, space, or enthusiasm that the only way you can do it is by pouring ingredients into a box and pushing a button, don't bother. Go buy some good craft beer at your local brewery instead. Brewing your own beer should be a hands-on process, one that teaches you about the brewer's art and puts your personal stamp on the end result for better or worse. The entire purpose behind these devices is to allow you to skip all that, so why brew in the first place? So don't come here looking for recommendations as to which is the best Keurig for craft beer. By the way, I make my coffee by grinding whole beans I buy from Colati Brothers and then put in a French press. That's it for this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. Our closing quote this time is from the great Babe Ruth. Sometimes when I reflect on all the beer I drink, I feel ashamed. Then I look into the glass and I think about the workers in the brewery and all their hopes and dreams. If I didn't drink this beer, they might be out of work and their dreams would be shattered. I think it's better to drink this beer and let their dreams come true than be selfish and worry about my liver. So on that note, folks, go out and help keep those craft breweries in business. This is your host, Bill Howell, drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna, and we'll see you next month. Cheers. Well, don't settle for the first, for it might be the worst. Cleanse your palate before you quench your thirst.